So as mentioned, this is a talk about biometric key generators. This is joint work with Seni Kamara and Mike Reiter. Seni and I did this while we were at Johns Hopkins. Seni has recently moved on to Microsoft Research, and I recently started at Google. So before we get going, I'd like to thank our advisor, Fabian Munros, who's now at UNC, Dan Lopresti from Lehigh University, and this work was funded by NSF and the Bradford Fellowship. So as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about biometric cryptographic key generators, which I call BKGs. And basically, we're going to be focusing on the way that these objects are evaluated. So we've been working in this area for quite some time, and we see lots of different proposals. And some of them are pretty good, and some of them break horribly, and we want to know why. We see certain patterns that show up again and again, and we want to try and stop these patterns. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at ways that these things typically break. We're going to propose some requirements that people can use to evaluate their systems with a little more rigor. And then in order to provide some sort of motivation for people to use our techniques, we actually evaluate a few published systems. I talk about two of them here to show the importance of the techniques. So a little bit of background. We're living in a really exciting time with mobile technology, which is great. We can do business from anywhere. Unfortunately, that actually opens us up to new attack vectors. So, for instance, in the past, we didn't really need to worry about as much people stealing the disks from our computers, as we talked about in the previous talk. So now we do. Now somebody can pick our pocket, take our iPhone home, and pull the bits off our disk. So an easy solution, as again was mentioned in the previous talk, is that you can just encrypt the data on the disk. But actually, this kind of is a problem in that since these devices are mobile and we need to be able to access them anywhere, the way that we usually encrypt the data is to use keys that are derived from passwords. And as anybody knows who's been following Usenix security for the past 10 years or so, memorable passwords are often pretty easy to break. So what's the solution? What can we do about this? Well, a lot of really smart people put their heads together and say, well, why don't we just generate keys from humans? Humans are believed to be unique, and if it's coming from a human, then they can recreate the same key all the time. So what they're talking about is biometrics, and a biometric is simply a measure of a human's biological, physiological traits. When people say biometrics, most people think of iris codes or fingerprints or face, which are good examples. But in the context of key generation, a more interesting example are behavioral biometrics, one, because they're harder to surreptitiously capture, and two, because you can generate different keys from the same biometric modality. But some examples of this are voice and handwriting. I've even seen proposals for how people play poker or drive cars. So what's nice about all these is that they're believed to have really high entropy, which means they're good for keys, and they're believed to be relatively repeatable, so that's easy to manage. This is quite an idea. We've seen a lot of interest in the research community from iris codes, keystrokes in voice, signatures in handwriting. We've seen even some more theoretical work, so-called fuzzy cryptography. And what's really nice about all these constructions is they come with some sort of security analysis. At the end of the paper, they say, our scheme is secure, and these are our logical reasons why, and so you can trust that the keys are pretty good. But then again, just as we've seen this rise in popularity, we've seen a lot of attacks. So we've seen attacks that try and extract the biometric by interacting with the key generator. We've seen attacks that show that the original definitions weren't quite correct, and other attacks against template designs. And it's sort of disheartening, and it's actually a little puzzling, because there was an argument that these things are actually secure. So what's going on? Why on one side we see security, and on the other side we see breaks? Well, I think the primary problem is these objects are just really difficult to evaluate. You have people with all sorts of expertise working on the objects. You have cryptographers designing secure templates. You have systems people generating or designing scanners for the biometric readings. And you have other people working on pattern recognition. And so there's really not this... there's different ideas of what it means to be secure. Some people take an empirical approach to estimate the entropy of the keys. Other people take a cryptographic approach, assuming that the entropy exists, even when it may not. And so we run into these problems. And also we have different adversarial models. Some people might think that certain information is easy to get, while other people don't. So we wanted to solve this problem and basically find a common ground for everybody working in this field so that they can understand what it means to have a secure BKG. So our main goal is to reduce the prevalence of these broken systems, And the way we're going to go about doing that is just examine current practices, pointing out subtleties and pitfalls, and then make some suggestions on new ways to evaluate these systems. So we'll revisit the known requirements, and we'll also present some new ones, and we highlight the importance of these with some concrete examples. In this talk, I just mentioned that we need both cryptographic and empirical analysis of BKGs. In this talk, we're mostly going to focus on the empirical side. One, because biometrics are inherently empirical, and if you can't get any entropy to the crypto, then the crypto's pretty worthless. And two, it fills a void, since most of the security analysis is actually happening on the crypto components. We're also going to stress the importance of publicly available auxiliary information and how things that are available to an attacker can turn out to be quite useful. All right, so let's just talk about BKGs for a little while. So a BKG usually operates in two phases, an enrollment phase and a key generation phase. Enrollment phase, basically, the user comes to the system, provides some number of biometric samples, the system applies some statistical functions or features to the samples, and then operates on those functions, or the output of those functions. This happens in the enrollment algorithm, which establishes some error correction information, does some randomness extraction, spits out two items. The first is a key, and this is just like, say, a standard AES key, whatever, and a template. And the template is used to later regenerate the biometric from only one, regenerate the key from only one sample. Now, what's important is in our scenario, we need to be able to decrypt our data or use the key wherever we want. So the template needs to be available, say, next to the ciphertext. So this template needs to be public information, and it needs to be secure. You can't basically just encode the biometric in the template. So during key generation, the user comes back, provides another sample. The system takes the template, applies the function, the features to the sample, and extracts the key. So if the sample is similar to the original sample's enrollment, then the keys output by these two stages will be the same. So why is this a hard thing to evaluate? Well, you got a couple things that you need to protect. Basically, you need to ensure that the key looks random. That's just to ensure that the cryptographic applications that are sitting on top of it will get the security they need or the entropy they need. You also need to protect the biometric because, well, there's two reasons. One, it's not revocable. It's sort of a part of who you are, and you know you don't really want everybody to know your biometric, maybe. Two, if an attacker can get the biometric from the template or something, then they can just run the key generator themselves and spit out your key. So we need to secure both of these pieces of information. And we have to secure them against a lot of different type of attackers. So attackers that would just guess a biometric, attackers that might just guess a key, attackers that might do something more sophisticated by looking at general patterns in biometrics across the population. So for instance, looking at open source or open databases of iris codes, for example, or capturing biometrics from their friends. They might take all those and try and use that to guess the most likely biometric, or maybe get some information from the template. The point is there are a lot of attacks here. There's a lot to sort of worry about. And what we did is we sat down for a while and we tried to produce a small number of requirements that people could use to evaluate their systems. So I'm not really going to go into the nitty-gritty details of that. You can look at the paper for more details. But there's two main requirements. Key randomness, which basically just ensures that the crypto will work if you use the BKG. And then strong biometric privacy, meaning that the biometric will not be released. So key randomness, we're going to give an adversary a lot of power. We're going to give him access to population statistics. We're going to let him run enroll and get templates, let him generate some keys. And then we're also going to give them the user's template because this is public information. And then we say a scheme achieves key randomness. If given all this, the adversary still cannot distinguish the key from random. Strong biometric privacy is simple. We give the adversary the same information, but we do something that's a little bit outside the norm, and we give them access to the key. This is the key that the user outputs during enrollment or key gen. And the reason we do this is actually motivated by practice. Well, let me finish the requirement, but first of all, we say the scheme achieves strong biometric privacy if, given all this information, the attacker doesn't learn much information about the biometric. So back to the key. This is motivated by practice. Keys in real life will be released for any number of reasons. So, for instance, if you're using it for message authentication codes, you might release the key to verify the code. We saw in the previous talk how you can extract keys from memory. So it's really important that these keys can't be used to reverse engineer the biometric. So let's get into what I think is the more interesting part of the talk, and we'll go through some actual case studies. The first one is an analysis of key randomness, and we'll show that the way that people sort of estimated the entropy of the keys, it's kind of kind of have some problems. And let's go into details. So we talk about the biometric hash algorithm that was published in the Journal of Applied Signal Processing in 2004. And the basic idea is we're going to generate keys from handwriting. So we apply some features to the handwriting. We error correct the output of the features and use that to generate a key. So the authors described a template encoding algorithm, and they went into a lot of detail talking about how to measure the quality of these features. And the reason that we picked this scheme is that it's very, very similar to many other constructions for different type of modalities, uses similar error correcting techniques, similar key generation techniques, and so our analysis applies to these others as well. At the same time, the way that they estimate entropy is also really common. So this is a nice representative sample. So the enrollment algorithm works as follows. You start with some number of biometric samples. You apply some features to them. And the features are basically just a function that maps a biometric sample to a point on a real number line. And so we want to error correct this to one unique value. So what we're going to do is we're going to use quantization and chop up the number line into bins that are equal width. And we assign an index to each bin. And then to derive the key, we derive a piece of the key from each feature. And we just use the bin index as the piece of information that's going into the key for a specific feature. So in the end, you would have the bin index of each feature as your key. And of course, we need to be able to come back later and regenerate this key. So we have to encode the template. And the basic way that they do this, and I'm improvising a little bit, but it's basically the same thing. They take a random offset in this space. And then they take the width, and they encode this offset and the bin width in the template. And they do this for each feature. And I'll show you how you can use that to regenerate the key. So you come back later. You get a new biometric sample. You apply a feature to the sample. Again, it maps to the real number line. And then you take an offset in the space. And then you take the width. And you just basically unroll it across the whole space so you get the same partitioning. And if the key index, if the biometric is similar to the original one, the key index that's output will be the same. So this is a construction in the nutshell. And they did security analysis. Their basic analysis was templates don't leak information about keys or biometrics because you only have the error-correcting widths and you have the offsets within the number line. So I don't know if I completely buy that, but we're not going to focus on that today. Then they go on and spend a lot of time empirically estimating the entropy of the keys. And they compute probability distributions for each feature over the output indices. And they use these probability distributions to estimate entropy. And then they sum the entropy of all this associated with each feature to estimate the entropy of the entire key. So they make an assumption of feature independence here. So let's just look at an example to sort of understand what they're doing. Say we have a population of users that's just this red user and this blue user. So the blue user has a lot of samples, and it falls into bin 6. The bins are a little bit more narrow. The red user has samples that fall into bin 3, and the bins are a little bit wider. So what they do is they compute the entropy over the bin indices, in this case 6 and 4. So you get about one bit of entropy here. And then they repeat this process for all the features. So let's take a step back for a second. Basically what they're doing is they're just computing the entropy of the keys that they observe. But we argued that we need to consider publicly available information, such as templates, and the correlation between features, for example. And this actually plays a big role. Let's play a thought experiment. We have three users in our population, a blue user, a red user, a green user. And what we're going to do is first estimate the entropy using the classic technique, which is about 1.5 bits, because we have three different entries that show up the same number of times. And now let's play a game where we want to use two users to try and guess the output of the other user. So what we do is take the target user's template, very simple, and we just take the samples from the other users and we put it into the target user's template. And 2/3 of them fall into the correct bin. We can repeat this experiment, and all of them fall in the correct bin. And one more time, half of them fall in the correct bin. So even though there's supposedly 1.58 bits of entropy here, if we follow the population, we guess the correct value on the first try. Now, I admit this kind of looks like a contrived example. It's for illustrative purposes, but we'll come back to it in a minute and show what an impact it has. The next thing that we wanted to study was the impact of auxiliary information, namely the correlation between features. So what I'm showing here is a heat map, of the mutual information between each of the features that were proposed. And basically, if you look at the box IJ in this map, that's the mutual information between feature I and feature J. Ideally, we'd like to see a completely white map and a dark diagonal line. Unfortunately, as you see, there are actually areas in here that are quite a bit darker, and in fact, these features are highly correlated with one another. So this assumption of independence is really not the best. All right, so I've sort of beat on these guys a little bit, saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing this, but does it really matter? I mean, maybe this is just an academic exercise, and it doesn't really look like the keys will be affected. Maybe their estimates are okay. So we wanted to answer this question, and we did so, so what we did was design an algorithm that tries to take advantage of the observations that we've made, and then compare the results of the algorithm to the entropy that the standard estimates provide. So the basic idea is that we need to guess the bin indices of each feature at the same time. And we're going to model this as a search through a tree, where at depth I, we guess the output of feature I. So a path all the way down to the leaf nodes in the tree is basically a guess of a key. So an efficient algorithm is going to find the correct path through this tree very quickly. So the way that we decide to go about this problem is to use population statistics to guess the most likely value and use the user's template to refine the guess and use the conditioning between features to refine the guess further. So basically, we start with a set of features and we reorder them so that those with low indices have lower entropy and higher mutual information with the other features. And you can't get this perfectly. We used a heuristic that's detailed in the paper. And then we just started to search through the tree. So we start with feature one. And we look at the population, and we look at the most likely value that occurs in the population. We follow that path. Then we repeat this at depth 2, and we follow the most likely value as indicated by the population, but we condition it on the path that we followed at depth 1. And then we do this again for depth 3 using the conditioning on from the first two levels and follow this all the way down to the leaves of the tree. So at the bottom, we verify the key. If it's wrong, we backtrack. And then we try and find, we take the second most likely value, and so on and so forth. So this algorithm is nice because it sort of cuts out a big part of the tree at the very beginning because we're guessing the features that are easier to use. And it's using conditioning to sort of influence the guesses of the harder features at the end. So we wanted to evaluate this. So we use our data set from Usenet Security 2006, which consisted of handwriting from about 50 users. They wrote the same 5 passphrases 10 to 20 times. Which resulted in approximately 9,000 writing samples. And an important thing to know about this data set, it was collected in a controlled environment that tried to promote consistency and individuality. So these are two properties that would be nice to have for a biometric for key generation. So these are the algorithm results. First, I'll show you the standard estimate of entropy. In our case, it was 43 bits. So this graph shows a CDF of the expected number of guesses that one would need to make before finding the correct key in a 43-bit space. At about, you'd find 50% of the keys in about 2 to 42 guesses, so on and so forth. And then we ran our algorithm, and we got this. So this green line here is the CDF of what our algorithm faced, and 15% of the time we guessed the value correctly on the very first try. We just followed one branch through the tree. So these requirements that we're asking to be met, like conditioning on the template, they're really important. 50% of the time we found the key in fewer than 2 to 22 guesses. And this is supposed to be a 43-bit space. So what happened? Well, the claim security was 43 bits. In actuality, there wasn't really any security for a large majority of the population. Where's the disconnect? Well, the evaluation overlooked public information, as I just mentioned, and in particular, the user-specific variation that was in the templates for error correction was augmenting artificially the entropy estimates of the using the standard approach. Some positive takeaways: now we see this, and people won't repeat the mistakes. And at the same time, we propose a new information measure in our paper. We're not going to talk about it here, but it's called guessing distance, and you can look at the paper if you're interested. All right, let's move on to strong biometric privacy. This is a scheme that appeared in IEEE transactions on computers, and they use iris codes to lock keys, basically. So some work was pretty popular, and they did some nice stuff in there. They talked about the different types of error patterns that usually appear, and they talked about comprising different error correcting codes to correct for both random and bursty errors, and that was nice. It's another representative sample, so this is actually a variant of what's called a fuzzy commitment. And there's a lot of people out there that try and use these for key generation purposes, and we're going to show why that's a problem. So here's how the scheme works very simply. We start with an iris code, and we extract it from an image, and all you need to know is that it outputs a string of 2048 bits that has about 256 bits of entropy, so quite a bit of entropy. Then what you do is you take a random key that you output using some random number generator, and you error correct encode it, and then you XOR that with the iris code. All right, and the template just consists of those XORed values and a hash of the original key, which will be used for verification later. To regenerate a key, you come back with the template. You come back with a new reading of the iris code, which might differ, might have some errors because it's a biometric modality. And you XOR these together, and you're left with the error encoded key plus some errors. So you can decode that, and if you don't have a lot of errors, you get the original key. So they did a very complicated security analysis, and they reasoned, due to their error correction techniques, they got about 40 bits of entropy here. And their security analysis of the biometric privacy and key randomness basically was, you know, you can't extract the iris because it's XORed with an error encoded key, and you can't extract the key because it's XORed with the iris code. We're not really going to worry about that too much, but what we are going to do is drill into one thing that they observe, that you can lock a new key if the key is ever compromised. So if you remember, I talked about earlier, when you're valuing biometric privacy, you have to assume that an attacker might get access to this key, because this could happen in real life. If this does happen, since the template stores the iris code XORed with the error corrected key, it's very simple to later come back with the key and extract the iris code by just XORing the two together. So the implications of this is a complete loss of privacy, and you can actually never use the BKG ever again after this point. So what happened here? Well, again, there's a big difference between the claim security and the actual security in a realistic model. And the disconnect was that the model that was being used doesn't really account for realistic scenarios. But a positive takeaway is, now that we've proposed our requirements, hopefully evaluators won't make similar mistakes in the future. So I'm going to conclude with that, and I'd like to say that, you know, BKGs might offer a solution to the password problem. Some of you might be skeptical about that. I invite you to stay tuned. We have some semi-positive results in that area coming out soon. And the reason that I say that it might offer a secure solution is that we don't really know, because the evaluations that we've seen so far have these problems. So we need to bring the communities together, and hopefully this paper is a first step towards that. Everybody can sort of understand the type of security model that we really need. And we need to start analyzing with a critical eye, considering publicly available information and paying, in particular, attention to empirical estimates, which are not easy to do. So that's all I have. Thanks.
Any questions or comments? Okay. Wow, great talk. Everything was clear. Yeah. Thanks.